Welcome to Module 7 of the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. In this module, we'll talk about how to connect your informal classroom visits to the formal teacher evaluation process, and I'll share with you my system for completing that process with less wasted time and a much sharper focus on the outcomes you want to create. Teacher evaluation is a big deal in our profession because it's how we ensure and demonstrate that we have qualified people doing the work in our schools. But evaluation has become something of a Frankenstein's monster as more and more different purposes and processes have been attached to the evaluation process. It's not uncommon to see teacher evaluation processes that include professional goal setting, student growth goal setting, professional learning goals, links to school accountability goals, PLC goals, the use of standardized test data, and all sorts of other things that you wouldn't find in employee evaluations in any other profession. And because we've glommed so much on to the evaluation process, it's easy to confuse the rhetoric about what teacher evaluation is with the reality. For example, one myth that we're going to tackle in this module is the idea that the evaluation process helps teachers grow. And certainly, we can do things like goal setting and reflection that do help teachers grow. But the fact that they're attached to the evaluation process actually inhibits those processes from working as well as they could. So we're going to get very clear on what evaluation can and cannot do, so we can find ways to achieve those purposes as effectively and as efficiently as possible. But I don't want you to worry about whether your current evaluation process is a mess, because chances are that's not something you can change, at least not in the short term. So keep doing what you have to do to work within that process, but as you go through this module, look for ways to sharpen your focus on the key elements of teacher evaluation, starting with evidence and your teacher evaluation criteria. So let's get started. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. What we think of as the teacher evaluation process today is usually several different processes that have been lumped together for convenience. For example, if you have teachers set goals, there's a good chance you do that as an official part of the teacher evaluation process. But I'm going to guess that your teacher evaluation criteria say nothing at all about those goals, and whether or not the teacher achieves those goals often doesn't factor into the evaluation. In fact, a lot of what's in your instructional framework, which you identified in Module 5, isn't what your teachers are evaluated on. Only your actual teacher evaluation criteria serve as the basis for the formal evaluation. Why do we bolt so much on to the teacher evaluation process? I believe it's because evaluation is a fairly unpleasant subject, with a fairly negative emphasis on identifying and getting rid of poor performers. So we try to highlight the upsides of evaluation, like recognizing outstanding performance. But that doesn't work too well, because it's awkward to tell someone they're doing a good job in such quantitative, high-stakes terms. It's not how we normally communicate as humans. And if you're not sure what I mean, next time you're impressed or touched by something someone in your family does, like if your spouse buys you a gift, or if your kid draws you a picture, try rating it with a rubric, and you'll see what I mean. It's just not a good fit. So we've gone searching for additional processes that we can attach to the teacher appraisal process to mask and minimize that unpleasantness. So we add things like goal setting and coaching cycles and reflective conversations, none of which really help us evaluate the teacher's performance. And ideally, all of those other things that we're adding on are helpful. Reflection and goal setting are good things to do, but they're not evaluation. And when we combine them with evaluation, they actually become less effective in producing growth. What is it about evaluation that inhibits growth? At the most basic level, fear. When teachers' jobs are on the line, as they are in the evaluation process, it's perfectly rational for teachers to be less willing to take risks and try new things. The idea of a competency trap, which we discussed in Module 3, is a perfect example. If we want teachers to try new things, the formal evaluation process is not the time, because teachers know they get worse before they get better, and the worst possible time to be evaluated is while you're at the bottom of that learning curve, when you've already given up something that you were good at, but you're not yet good at the new practice that you're trying to adopt. Teachers know this, and they're smart. So often what you'll find is that when you're invited to see something new that a teacher's been working on so that you can give feedback, what's really happening is that the teacher has already gotten good at the new practice and just wants to be recognized. They don't need the feedback to get through the learning curve because they already have. Or in other cases, you'll be invited to observe when the teacher is trying something totally new and they know you'll cut them some slack because they're trying something new, when what they're really trying to do is keep you from seeing their normal day-to-day practice. In his book, Rethinking Teacher Supervision and Evaluation, Kim Marshall calls the traditional formal observation a dog and pony show. And although I've never seen an actual dog and pony show, so I don't know where that term comes from, I'm sure you've heard it too. When an observation is prearranged and the teacher knows you're coming to observe, it's a pretty safe assumption that what you're seeing is not a typical lesson. For one thing, a lot more effort probably went into planning the lesson than usual. The teacher may have done some pre-teaching the day before to make sure students are ready to put their best foot forward during the observation, and students may have even been given special instructions about how to behave. The late Rick Dufour, who's best known for making professional learning communities explode in popularity over the past 20 years, used to tell the story of how he'd prepare for an observation when he was a teacher. He'd say to his class, "If I ask a question while the principal's in the room, I want every hand to go up. If you know the answer, raise your right hand, and if you don't know the answer, raise your left hand and I won't call on you." Now, I'm pretty sure he was joking, but you get the point. When a single observation is so high stakes, there's a lot of pressure to put on a good show. So what do we do about this as evaluators? Simple. We recognize the dog and pony show dynamic and we move on. If you're required to observe for an hour at an agreed upon time so the teacher knows you're coming, great. Go with it and just consider that the best case scenario in terms of what that teacher is capable of in the classroom. Just be aware, they're probably not going to try something new and risky, and they probably don't teach that way every day. To really evaluate teachers fairly, we can't limit ourselves to the information we get from these staged, high-stakes, formal observations. So in an upcoming section, I'll explain why every bit of evidence you have about a teacher, and in fact, everything you know about that teacher, is relevant for their evaluation. You can't always use it all, for example, a rumor or something that a parent reported that their kid reported to them, but it's important that we be honest with ourselves, that we evaluate teachers holistically, based on everything we know about their practice as it relates to our evaluation criteria. So again, if your evaluation process has a lot of other activities tied to it, and some of those activities are capable of producing growth, great. But the process of actually observing and rating a teacher against a set of criteria by itself doesn't help that teacher get better. So you may be wondering, what's the point? What's the purpose of evaluation if it doesn't help teachers improve? I believe it's this: to initiate appropriate next steps for each teacher, whatever those may be. We'll talk more about this later in the module, but the two big categories of next steps are simply positive and negative. On the negative side, we have things like plans of improvement and probation and even dismissal. And on the positive side, we have things like increased trust, greater autonomy, and perhaps more of a leadership role. But the evaluation process is essentially a decision-making process. And this takes us back to an idea I shared with you at the very beginning of Module 1. The idea that instructional leadership is largely about making decisions. And to make those decisions well, we need information that we can only get from being in classrooms. When it comes to evaluating teachers and making high-stakes decisions about their performance, the dog and pony show formal observation doesn't give us enough information. So what can we do about that? That's our focus throughout the rest of this module. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. When you fully implement the high-performance instructional leadership model and visit 3 classrooms a day, every day, and start taking notes in your third cycle of visits, you'll begin to accumulate a huge amount of evidence just from those informal visits. When you get around to every teacher 15 or 20 times a year, you'll have an incredible amount of evidence to work with. But a lot of people think, since those aren't formal observations, that they don't count in the final evaluation, and that you can't use any evidence you collect from informal visits. It's important to check the specific language of your teacher contract and evaluation policy, but from a philosophical standpoint, I could not disagree more strongly. It puzzles me when people treat teaching like an Olympic sport, where all that matters is 1 or 2 brief performances that are judged. If you're an Olympic high diver or figure skater, it makes sense to me that only your official performance would count. It wouldn't be fair for the judges to show up to practice and take off points for mistakes that you make while you're training. But teaching isn't like that. Teachers are on all the time, not just when we're observing. So how we evaluate teaching is fundamentally different from how an Olympic sport is judged, because we don't observe teachers the entire time they're performing. The Olympic high dive from 30 meters in the air lasts only 2 seconds or so. Over the course of a school year, teachers teach for about 1,000 hours, yet we only do formal observations for about 1 or 2 hours in most cases. That's about 0.1 or 0.2% of teachers' overall teaching time, and that's not even counting the work they do outside of class to prepare. If an Olympic judge saw only 0.1% of a 2-second dive, that would be far less than 1 still frame of the video. You'd have to use a high-speed camera to capture 0.1 or 0.2%. Olympic judges see all of the performance. It's not practical for us to see everything in a teacher's practice, and we really don't need to. But to make an accurate and fair judgment about a teacher's performance in the classroom, we do need plenty of evidence. And one or two or even three formal observations just can't give us very much. They give us a best case scenario, that dog and pony show that we talked about earlier in this module. But there's another problem with evaluating teachers as if we're judges at the Olympics, and that's that what we see is just the tip of the iceberg. Teacher practice involves a lot of thinking and planning and preparing and making decisions, and it's only through conversation that we can get at those aspects of practice that are beneath the surface. If you do a great job with your pre- and post-conferences, the formal observation process can give you some good insights into all of that. But I want to suggest that we should think more broadly about our sources of information for making teacher evaluation decisions. In fact, we should think extremely broadly, because our judgments about teachers are largely holistic and intuitive judgments. But there's a difference between information and evidence. And that difference is important, because often our intuitions are wrong. They don't line up with the evidence and the evaluation criteria. And that means we can't triangulate. So it's extremely important to look for that alignment and to make sure that our high-stakes decisions about teachers are based on clear and defensible triangulation between the evidence and the evaluation criteria. So if you have information about a teacher, but it's not really evidence, for example, if a parent complains to you that the work students are doing isn't rigorous enough, or if you hear that a teacher is a yeller, but you haven't seen it for yourself, what can you do? Information that doesn't rise to the level of evidence is still useful if you allow it to guide your collection of further evidence. For example, if someone tells me they heard a teacher yelling at his class, but that teacher denies it, I don't have to say, oh, well, I guess I don't have any evidence, and let it go. I can ask, what period was that when you heard him yelling at his class? And then I can make a habit of strolling by that classroom at different times throughout the day, and if I do happen to hear some yelling, I can make that one of my informal classroom visits. And if I document it the right way, I can probably even turn it into an unscheduled formal observation. Now, you'll have to check with your supervisor or human resources department or teacher contract for the specifics, but in most schools and districts I've consulted with, there's no real restriction on using evidence from unannounced visits in the final evaluation. As long as it's documented, it's fair game. And if you're following the high-performance instructional leadership model for your informal visits, as we discussed in Module 6, then you're always taking notes and emailing them to the teacher immediately, so you'll always have this documentation. Now, in case you're thinking this is a little unfair to teachers to say that everything is fair game for the evaluation, I want to point out that this is actually better for teachers. When all you have is one or two formal observations and the whole evaluation is based on just 1 or 2 hours out of a 1,000-hour school year, those 1 or 2 hours become very high stakes. On the other hand, if a teacher knows I'm going to visit 15 or 20 times in addition to those formal observations, the pressure in any one visit drops considerably. And because I'm generating so much more evidence in the form of my notes that I'm sharing with the teacher, there's much more safety for the teacher, much more protection against an unfair evaluation. Because if I rate the teacher too harshly and I'm not fairly triangulating the evidence with the rubric, the teacher can call me on that. The teacher has, in my own words, pages and pages of evidence. So if I've made the wrong argument in the final evaluation, that can be corrected. So the bottom line is, everything you know about a teacher is relevant for their final evaluation. Not everything counts as evidence, but if you don't have evidence, at least you can be aware of the areas in which you need to gather more evidence for certain teachers. And then you can be on the lookout for what you need. So now, I'd like to ask you, what are the rules for what counts in the formal evaluation process in your school or district? What's fair game and what's off limits? Can you turn an unannounced observation into a formal observation? Do you have to have a post-conference or fill out a form for it to count? If you're not sure, now is the time to ask, and I'd like to hear from you. Let me know, using the form below, what counts in the formal evaluation. And if you have any questions about how to work within your teacher contract or the rules of your district, just let me know, and I'll be happy to get back to you on how you can conduct the best possible evaluations based on the available evidence. Fill out that form below, and I'll see you in the next section. In this section, I'm going to share with you my system for completing the formal evaluation process in a way that gets dramatically better results without taking up more of your time. Earlier in this module, I said that the purpose of teacher evaluation isn't to produce growth, but instead to initiate appropriate next steps for each teacher, whatever those steps may be. When we let go of the idea that we're making teachers better when we evaluate them, we can also let go of a lot of the waste that usually accompanies the evaluation process. The reason the evaluation process has grown into this Frankenstein's monster of different steps and processes is that we think we have to make it beneficial for everyone. We want every single teacher to get something out of their evaluation. But the reality is, the evaluation itself is not helpful to most teachers. And let's be honest, most normal human beings would prefer not to be evaluated. It's not fun, and it's not helpful. But it is necessary. So what can we do to make better use of our time? The evaluation process consumes dozen or even hundreds of hours a year of your time, and because the appropriate next steps for a lot of teachers are keep doing what you're doing, we can save ourselves an enormous amount of time by expediting those evaluations. On the other hand, we have a big opportunity to get better results with the teachers who aren't doing as well, who may be at risk of a negative evaluation. With negative evaluations, the greatest risk is that we'll put in a ton of work and identify the appropriate next steps for an underperforming teacher, only to have those next steps not stick. If you've ever had a negative evaluation overturned, perhaps by your human resources department or your school board or even a judge, you know how demoralizing that can be. And often, when a teacher realizes they're going down, they often try to take you with them. So the impact on the culture of your school can be just awful. So if you're going to do a negative evaluation because that's what the pattern of evidence suggests is the most appropriate rating, make sure it's going to have a positive impact for students. It needs to result either in an action plan that will help the teacher improve, or it needs to result in the teacher being replaced by someone who will do a better job. So what does it take to make that happen? Two things, evidence and time. I've already given you a great plan for collecting that evidence, but it's going to take an enormous amount of time to do the writing that's necessary for transforming that evidence into an airtight evaluation. Later on in this module, I'm going to take you through the CEIJ format, which will help you use your evidence to create a rock-solid argument about a teacher's performance. But let me tell you right now, the writing is incredibly time-consuming. But what I'm not going to suggest is that you suddenly start spending far more time on teacher evaluations. I know the reality, you don't have more time. So what I'm going to suggest instead is a radical reallocation of that time. Instead of spending roughly equal time on each teacher's evaluation with a little bit more time devoted to your negative evaluations, I want you to make a radical shift using the 80-20 rule. The 80-20 rule, or Pareto principle, is the idea that 80% of our efforts produce just 20% of our results, and fully 80% of our results come from just 20% of our efforts. So if we spend roughly equal time on each teacher's evaluation, what we're going to find is that a lot of that time goes to waste. For your strong teachers, who are doing great and just need to keep on growing, every hour you put into their evaluation is almost a complete waste. You still have to do the evaluation, and you have to make sure the process is fair to everyone, but I want to give you permission to prioritize. The reality is, for many of your teachers, no one cares about their evaluation or how much time you put into it. It needs to get done, but it doesn't need to be a 10-hour project. And in fact, I want you to radically reallocate the time that you're currently spending on evaluating teachers that everyone knows are great using the 80-20 rule. Let's say you have 30 teachers, and for the sake of argument, let's say you spend 2 hours on each teacher's evaluation, not counting the observations and the meetings you have with teachers. That means you're spending 60 hours writing evaluations. If you reallocate that time using the 80-20 rule, instead of spending 2 hours for each teacher, you'll spend 48 hours, or 80% of the total 60, evaluating just 20% of your teachers, which comes out to just 6 teachers if you have a staff of 30. So each of those 6 teachers is going to get an evaluation that you've put 8 hours into. 6 times 8 is 48. And then the remaining 24 teachers are going to get evaluations that you've put just 12 hours total into writing, which comes out to just 30 minutes apiece. It's the same total amount of time, but radically reallocated. You're probably wondering how to divide your staff into those 80% and 20% groups and how to complete those 80% of your evaluations in just a few minutes each. So that's what we'll talk about in our next couple of sections. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you there. If you're going to spend dramatically less time on the evaluations of 80% of your teachers so you can devote more time to just 20%, how do you decide who goes in each group? The key is to think in terms of risk. Which teachers are at the greatest risk of getting a negative evaluation? Now, it would be highly unusual for 20% of your staff to actually get an unsatisfactory evaluation at the end of the year, but there's always a degree of uncertainty. For example, if you have a new teacher, you might have high hopes for them, but you really don't know how things are going to pan out. or if you have someone who's been struggling for a while, floating just above the satisfactory level, you might want to include them in that high-risk 20%. Some will turn out to be fine, and others may ultimately get an unsatisfactory evaluation, but either way, you'll be prepared if you put them in the 20% group. The rest of your staff are going to get an expedited evaluation, which you might think of as kind of similar to TSA pre-check status. Everyone who gets on an airplane has to go through security, just as every one of your teachers has to get an evaluation. Nobody gets skipped. But in the US, if you're a frequent flyer, you can apply for a program called TSA Pre-Check, which includes a thorough background check, and if you pass, you can go through security much more quickly than everyone else. The reason this system works reasonably well is that a lot of information is known about people who have pre-check status. On the other hand, not as much information is available about some flyers, so there's a higher risk. And if there's a specific concern about a certain flyer, they're likely to experience enhanced screening. Now, I don't want to push the metaphor too far, and we'll talk about what to do with those higher risk evaluations in another section. But for now, let's think more about those pre-check teachers. Why are they a lower risk, and what does that mean for how we evaluate them? First, I want to be very clear, we still follow the process and adhere to all the procedures for observations and post-conferences and paperwork and so forth. We're not skipping any steps, just as those pre-check flyers still have to at least go through the metal detector at the airport. But we're not going to belabor the process. It's little more than a formality because there's so little chance of there being a problem that we haven't already detected. But this only works in the context of frequent classroom visits. It's absolutely not the case that if someone has worked in your school for 10 or 15 years, that you should just completely leave them alone and assume they're doing fine. People can run into trouble at any stage in their careers, often for reasons related to their health or personal life. If someone's dealing with an illness or a divorce or caring for a sick family member, things can go downhill quickly. Back in Module 4, we talked about learning dynamics, the patterns of cause and effect that occur in the classroom. And one type of dynamic that can cause rapid declines in teacher performance is an amplifying negative feedback loop. For example, let's say a teacher is getting a divorce, and it's very distracting and emotionally draining and time-consuming, so he's not putting in as much time into planning lessons as he usually does. And as a result, his lessons aren't going as well, and because they're not as engaged, his students are starting to act up. And the feedback loop amplifies itself as the teacher responds to those behavior problems by planning even lower engagement lessons with lots of worksheets and bookwork. And as a result, he's not enjoying his job as much anymore, and the downward spiral just accelerates. So what do you do if you've put this teacher in your 80% pre-check group, and because you're visiting his classroom every 2 weeks or so, you realize that things are quickly going downhill? Well, that's easy. You simply move him to the other group and start paying much closer attention so you can provide the support he needs. And here's the thing. Whether someone is in the 80% group or the 20% group is totally in your head. There's nothing on paper. There's nothing you share with the teacher. It's simply a categorization that you do in your mind so you can devote your time and attention to the teachers who are likely to need it the most. So anytime you realize someone's in the wrong group, just move them. The next question is, how do you actually write those pre-check evaluations in so much less time? Well, that's easy too. You copy and paste. Allow me to explain. I've found that when you have a lot of evidence to work with, including that evidence in your final evaluations is really easy. You just copy and paste from your observation notes anytime you need to justify a claim about a teacher's performance. And for your 80% group, those claims are mostly positive and they're not going to be very controversial. Even so, writing claims is very time consuming. And while the evidence you've collected is unique for each teacher, the claims don't need to be. So this is the secret of how you write your pre-check evaluations in dramatically less time. Copy and paste the claims, then copy and paste specific evidence from your notes to justify that claim for that teacher. You're not mixing up evidence between different teachers. That would be unethical, but there's nothing wrong with making the same claim about multiple teachers if it's true about each of them. For example, if I'm looking at Danielson's Domain 3, Component C, Engaging Students in Learning, it might take me a few minutes to come up with a good claim. I might come up with something like, Ms. Gonzalez designs carefully structured learning activities that provide students with opportunities for deep intellectual engagement and complex thinking. Then I would need to justify that claim with evidence from a specific formal or informal observation. But before I do, I might want to stop and think about which other teachers fit that description. Can I copy and paste that sentence into other teachers' evaluations? Probably so. And if I do, that's going to save me a lot of time and effort writing those other evaluations. And you can even take this strategy to the extreme, starting at any point in the school year using a spreadsheet. I've provided a sample spreadsheet that you can download below this video. Here's how to use this spreadsheet to rapidly plan out your evaluations for each teacher on your pre-check list. First, you probably don't write something specific about every teacher evaluation criterion. If your rubric has 20 or 40 or 60 or more criteria spread across 5 or 10 different standards or domains, you're probably not writing a paragraph for each of those dozens of criteria. You're probably writing a summary statement for each overall standard or domain for each teacher. So in the columns of your spreadsheet, list those key areas that you're going to write about. For example, you might want to say something about each teacher's performance in instructional skill, in reflective practice, planning and preparation, and so on. Then paste in your teachers, the ones who are on your pre-check list, in the first column, and think through their practice in each domain. What would you say about Mr. Jones in the area of instructional skill? Well, you might think, okay, Mr. Jones isn't just outstanding. He actually leads professional development for the rest of the staff on instructional strategies. So you could abbreviate that in your spreadsheet with the code PDLEAD. Then you'd go down your list and you'd think about whether that same description fits anyone else. And you might realize, oh, Mr. Wong is the same way. He also leads PD on instructional strategies. So rather than write one thing about Mr. Jones and something completely different about Mr. Wong, I'm going to put the same label on each of them in my spreadsheet, PD Lead. Then, when I write a little blurb about Mr. Jones in the area of instructional skill, my spreadsheet will tell me, hey, you need to copy and paste that same statement into Mr. Wong's evaluation. And what you'll find is that for good teachers, you can do an incredible amount of copying and pasting those summary statements. You'll still need to find evidence that fits for each teacher, but you won't have to do all that writing from scratch. So if you have 24 pre-check teachers and you're going to write summary statements about each teacher in 5 different domains, you don't have to come up with 120 unique things to say. You may only need 3 or 4 per domain. And if you need more, you can always add them. When you use this strategy and this spreadsheet, your first few evaluations will probably take a more typical amount of time, like say an hour. But by the time you get to the bottom of the list, you'll already have done almost all the writing you need. So if you get down to Mr. Wong and you know he's a great teacher and your boss knows he's a great teacher, and you know he's going to get that evaluation and look it over for about 30 seconds and then sign it and give it back to you, you know you don't need to spend an hour writing his evaluation. If you've already done all the writing and you've copied and pasted the evidence from your visits to his class, you can probably knock this one out in 5 or 10 minutes. So give this a try. Download the spreadsheet and fill in your pre-check teachers. Then fill in the first few columns with the specific domains you're going to write about in your final evaluation reports. Then start creating those summary statements and abbreviations, and you'll be well on your way to completing evaluations in a fraction of the usual time. Now, this works great for those pre-check teachers, but it doesn't work at all for high-risk teachers who may be getting an unsatisfactory evaluation. So we'll talk about what to do with them in a separate section. That's it for now, though. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. At the beginning of Anna Karenina, Tolstoy writes, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Everything was in confusion in the Oblonskys' house." In our line of work, great teachers may not all be exactly alike, but they have a lot in common. And as we've seen, that means we can save ourselves a lot of time and effort by reusing evaluation language that applies to more than one teacher. When it comes to struggling teachers, though, we're up against what I call the Anna Karenina principle. Every struggling teacher struggles in their own way, and everything is in confusion. Based on what you know now, you can make a list of about 20% of your teachers who are at the highest risk for receiving an unsatisfactory evaluation. You don't know exactly how each of them will do between now and when evaluations are due, so we're intentionally making this a fairly large group. It would be highly unusual for that many teachers in one school to actually get unsatisfactory evaluations, but because it could be any of them, we need to be prepared for each of them. And the way we need to prepare is by gathering evidence very deliberately. And as you gain more information about each teacher's performance and triangulate that with your teacher evaluation criteria, you can start to fill in which criteria you have enough evidence for and which you don't. Back at the beginning of this module, I said the purpose of teacher evaluation is to initiate appropriate next steps for each teacher, whatever those may be. So if the appropriate next step is probation or dismissal, it's important to get clear on what it takes, according to the policies of your organization and according to your teacher's contract, to initiate those next steps. For example, you may find that if you have four domains that teachers are evaluated in, an unsatisfactory rating in any one domain is enough to trigger an unsatisfactory overall evaluation. Or you may find that new teachers are allowed to be basic in a certain domain, but need to be satisfactory in all of the others. It's going to vary, but it's essential to get clear on those rules. Once you're clear, you can focus your energy accordingly. If I have a teacher who's struggling with classroom management, all that extra effort I'm putting into his evaluation is going to be focused on classroom management, not the other domains that aren't as big a concern. This will save you time, and it'll ensure that you get better results in the areas you do focus on. But there's an even more important reason to focus only on the domains you need to, and that is the need to maintain the moral high ground. I want to caution you against throwing the book at someone. If you're going to write a negative evaluation, do so surgically, with precision, and resist the temptation to use the evaluation as an all-out attack on the teacher. Here's why this is important. If you're going to do something that's bad for a teacher, it needs to be because it's good for kids. But even so, you need to treat that teacher fairly. And it's easy for us as leaders to get worked up about teachers who aren't getting it done for kids, but we need to be careful to stay focused. If someone is terrible at classroom management, that might justify pursuing termination. But that doesn't mean you need to say they're also terrible at, say, communicating with parents or collaborating with their colleagues if they're not. It's of the utmost importance that we be honest and even-handed with the evidence, because if other teachers see that we're throwing the book at one of their colleagues and they compare themselves with that person and think, I'm not sure I'm all that different, then we run the risk of helping that teacher recruit allies in the fight against our evaluation. So as you gather more evidence for your lowest 20% of teachers, you're going to do a similar 80-20 analysis with the different domains of practice. If you spread your effort evenly across every single evaluation criterion, you might find that you don't have the evidence you need to make the case that someone is unsatisfactory. So the more you learn and the more evidence you collect, the more you'll know where to focus in your subsequent visits. Once you've identified those areas, look at your teacher evaluation criteria because you're going to get very familiar with them. When you're observing in classrooms, you still want to take factual, low-inference notes so you have evidence that the teacher can't really dispute or disagree with. But you want to take those notes using the language of your evaluation criteria. For example, if I have a teacher who's planning lousy lessons and I've worked with him and set expectations and sent him to training and provided mentoring and support and coaching, but he's still not planning good lessons, I'm not just going to say in his evaluation that he doesn't plan good lessons. I'm going to look at my evaluation criteria and find the specific language it uses to describe poor lesson planning. For example, I might look at the Danielson framework and see that the unsatisfactory column says things about activities being poorly aligned with instructional outcomes, and not following an organized progression, and not engaging students in active intellectual activity, and having unrealistic time allocations and groupings that are unsuitable. Now, those are statements that I can't put directly in my low inference notes. Those are judgmental statements, and my evidence needs to be separate from my judgments in order for it to support my judgments. So I can't put January 10th, teacher planned a lesson with activities that were poorly aligned with instructional outcomes. I need to stay a step down the ladder of inference, and I can do that effectively by thinking to myself, what would be an example that would triangulate with this description? For example, one thing that might be very easy to find is activities that don't engage students in active intellectual activity. So if I'm in the classroom, I might see that students are off task and unclear on the purpose of the lesson, or I might see that they're just copying off of one another rather than engaging intellectually, or I might see that they're doing something really passive and low in rigor, like a fill-in-the-blank worksheet. So I can document those specifics, not using the exact words from my rubric, but using words that will bring to mind those specific dimensions of poor performance. For example, my notes might say, students were given an assignment to read a chapter from the textbook, then work in small groups to complete a fill-in-the-blank worksheet of reading comprehension questions. In two different groups, one student found all the answers, and other students copied them onto their worksheets. One student asked, do we have to do another worksheet? Can't we do something that's not boring? By the end of the class period, when you asked students to turn in their work, 16 of the 28 students were finished with their worksheets. Now, in your raw notes that you share with the teacher, those particularly incriminating bits of evidence are going to be interspersed with plenty of neutral or positive evidence. Overall, the lesson may have seemed fine to the teacher, but you're no longer looking at the overall picture. You're zoomed in 80/20 on the specific areas that the teacher is struggling in. Because you're describing what happened, not what's missing from the lesson, like engagement and rigor, the teacher isn't going to argue with your factual statements. And that allows you to build the body of evidence you'll need to write a rock-solid final evaluation. We'll talk about how to do that writing in a separate section in this module when we'll talk about a format called CEIJ, which stands for Claim, Evidence, Interpretation, Judgment. For now, suffice it to say, this is a lot of work, and it's essential to continually prioritize and zoom in on the situations you need to know more about. If you end up with no concerns about a teacher you put on your high-risk 20% list because you've been visiting frequently and things have been good, nothing out of the ordinary needs to happen. Remember, this list is just in your head. Teachers don't know you're putting extra effort into their evaluations until they see the final product. And if you find that a teacher who's struggling in one area isn't struggling in another area, don't worry about collecting so much evidence for those criteria that the teacher's doing fine on. Zoom in 80/20 on just those specific domains and criteria where you need the most evidence. And if you're consistent about getting into classrooms, you'll have plenty of evidence. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. CEIJ is the single most powerful way to craft an argument about a teacher's performance. CEIJ stands for Claim, Evidence, Interpretation, Judgment. And because it spells each of those elements out in such detail, it's a guaranteed way to write an evaluation that will withstand the closest scrutiny. When we're conducting high-stakes evaluations, we know there's a good chance other people will cast a critical eye on what we write. Unlike the vast majority of our evaluations, which only a few people will look at very briefly, high-stakes evaluations may end up in front of a union rep, your supervisor, a human resources manager, an attorney, or even a judge. So it's essential that we get this right, and CEIJ is the perfect tool. First, let's talk about when not to use CEIJ. It's a ton of work, so you'll really only want to use it for high-stakes evaluations. The rest of the time, it's overkill. Remember, the purpose of teacher evaluation is to initiate appropriate next steps for each teacher. And if the appropriate next step is keep doing what you're doing, it doesn't take the world's greatest written evaluation to make that happen. You will occasionally want to use CEIJ for an important high-stakes positive evaluation. For example, if you're nominating a teacher for an award or a grant, CEIJ is a great format that'll make your recommendation stand out. We'll talk about using CEIJ for positives in another section of this module. But most of the time, CEIJ is a tool we use for our high-stakes negative evaluations. In those cases, we should expect that teachers will fight tooth and nail. So how does CEIJ help us win that fight? First, it helps us get very clear on the specifics of our argument about a teacher's performance. In our heads, we always have a mix of feelings and knowledge about each teacher, and not all of that can go into their evaluation. If it's not factual, and just as importantly, documented, it can't go into the evaluation. And even if you do have documented facts about a teacher's performance, if they're not relevant to your argument, they can weaken your evaluation by diluting its focus or making it look like you're just throwing the book at the teacher. Second, CEIJ connects the dots between patterns of teacher performance, the evidence that substantiates those patterns, the impact that that performance has on students, and the rating you ultimately give the teacher, leaving no room for an alternate interpretation. Let's walk through each aspect of the CEIJ format now. First, C stands for claim. The claim is a summary statement describing the teacher's typical practice in a given area. A claim is a generalization, and because you're building the habit of visiting classrooms 3 times a day, you're actually going to have enough evidence to justify that generalization. Earlier in this program, I argued that individual lessons aren't what we're evaluating, even though they're typically what we focus on when we're collecting evidence. Instead, we're evaluating the teacher's overall practice. And that's why it's appropriate to make a generalization in your claim. To write your claim, you can use the format blank's practice in the area of blank is characterized by blank. For example, let's say we have a teacher named Mr. Roberts who just teaches straight out of an old textbook without really preparing for class. We might write a claim like Mr. Roberts' instructional planning is characterized by a high degree of reliance on an outdated textbook that is no longer part of our adopted curriculum. Student learning activities overwhelmingly focus on reading the textbook and answering the questions at the end of each section, which are not aligned with our current standards and do not reflect high expectations for all students. So that would be a broad generalization about Mr. Roberts' practice. We're not just saying that that was the case one time, but that it's the norm in his class. But of course, that claim must be supported by evidence, the second part of the CEIJ format. Evidence is multiple, specific, documented incidents and instances that support the claim. This is where you'll go back to your verbatim low inference notes that you've been taking all year and that you've already shared with the teacher, and that you'll pull out a few examples from to support your claim. I like to have at least two examples, and if any of them are ambiguous or not especially compelling, you might want to have three or four. Write your evidence in the form of specific, dated examples. For Mr. Roberts, you might write, for example, on January 10th, students spent the entire period reading silently from the textbook and answering questions at the end of the chapter. Only 13 out of 27 students completed the assignment by the end of the period, and two students were sent to the office for disruptive behavior. The more your different examples can shine a light on different dimensions of the claim, the better. So I might also have evidence like, in another incident, on October 22nd, Mr. Roberts told the special education teacher that, quote, "If your kids can't do the work, they shouldn't be in my class," end quote. The special education teacher asked why Mr. Roberts was not using the district's adopted curriculum, and he replied that, quote, "This book has always been fine for the kids who are willing to do the work, so I don't know why you're teaching them to be lazy," unquote. The next part of CEIJ is the interpretation, and this is where we're going to connect the dots for the reader, so there's no ambiguity about the consequences of the teacher's practice. The interpretation is a clear articulation of the consequences of the teacher's typical practice. These consequences will often focus on student learning, but could focus on the student experience, school culture, relationships with colleagues, or other important outcomes. The goal here is to get the reader clear on why this matters. So we're going to use the phrase "as a result" to make that as unambiguous as possible. So for Mr. Roberts, we might say something like, "As a result of Mr. Roberts' over-reliance on outdated curriculum materials, students rarely experience engaging, rigorous lessons that help them master essential knowledge and skills." Then we bring it home with the judgment, which is simply the final rating of the teacher's overall practice in a specific area using the language and scale of the evaluation framework. So for Mr. Roberts, we might say, "Therefore, Mr. Roberts' practice in Domain 1, Component C, Setting Instructional Outcomes, is best described as unsatisfactory." So that's it. Claim, evidence, interpretation, judgment. The claim is a generalization about the teacher's overall practice in a specific area, and then it's backed by multiple pieces of evidence. And then we interpret that for the reader by explaining the consequences of that practice, and then we give the final rating. It's a fair amount of work, but when you have clear evaluation criteria and plenty of evidence, the format does a lot of the heavy lifting for you. It gets you clear on your argument so you can remove anything that would be a distraction, and so you can tell in advance if your argument is going to be compelling to others. Now, you might be wondering, what do I do if I can't find two or more pieces of evidence to use in my argument? Well, there are three things you can do. First, you can take another look at your notes. You may already have evidence that you've used to support a different claim that you can then reuse for the claim you're currently writing. There's no rule that says you can't use the same evidence multiple times. In fact, I highly recommend it. Second, if you have time, you might just want to look for more evidence next time you're in the classroom. If you know what's missing, you can keep an eye out for it and capture that evidence using the specific vocabulary of your teacher evaluation criteria. Third, if you really can't find the evidence you need, that means you'll have to revise your claim. If that happens, don't feel bad. A lot of our initial claims may be based on intuitions that may be correct, but may not be something we actually have evidence on. You may need to scrap the claim entirely, or you may need to just narrow it down a bit so that you're making a claim that you have specific evidence for. Get it right, and CEIJ is incredibly powerful. But don't worry, you don't have to get it right the very first time. In the next section, we're going to talk about developing rough draft CEIJ statements into polished, well-supported arguments that get the job done. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. If you're not sure how to get started with a CEIJ argument, I want to give you a rough draft process that you can use to get a jump on the process even very early in the year. Let's say you have a teacher, like Mr. Roberts, who isn't using the district's adopted curriculum and is just having students work from an old textbook without planning rigorous or engaging lessons that meet students' needs. you probably feel a certain sense of frustration and even outrage when you're in his class because you know kids deserve better. And that outrage mixes with everything else you know about Mr. Roberts. For example, if he's also grumpy in faculty meetings and he doesn't really pull his weight on committees, that can add to your frustration and to the list of things that you want to address. But we want the final evaluation to be very focused, so it initiates the appropriate next steps. And CEIJ can help us create that focus over time. So what we want to do is start with a rough draft claim. And you may want to do this for multiple different areas so you can figure out which ones are really going to pan out. Let's say you've just visited Mr. Roberts' class, and as always, you walk away with an intense feeling of frustration and even disgust at what you saw. This is a great time to fire up a document on your computer and write out some draft claims. You might start with something really unprofessional that you could never say in a formal evaluation, but that reflects how you feel. For example, you might say, Mr. Roberts is just phoning it in so he can collect retirement in a few years, and he really doesn't care about his students at all. He just gives them this horribly boring bookwork every day, he doesn't do any real lesson planning that I can see, and he's not even using the required curriculum. He's just using an old textbook that we got rid of 5 years ago because he says it's better on the fundamentals, whatever that means. He's incredibly grumpy with other staff members, including the special ed teacher who works with the students in his class who have IEPs. He's supposed to be collaborating with her to support them, but he just accuses her of enabling them to be lazy, and he won't work with her at all to create accommodations or modifications to support students' IEP goals. So when you do a brain dump like that, you're going to end up with a lot on the table. And while some of it can turn into a good CEIJ argument, we need to pick it apart to figure out what does and what doesn't align with our evaluation criteria. As a side note, when you do that, you can often find faster routes than using the evaluation process to address certain kinds of problems. For example, if it's a district policy that all teachers use the required curriculum, and Mr. Roberts has been dragging his feet on that for 5 years, you can use a directive immediately instead of waiting for the annual evaluation. You can use your positional power to order him to turn in the old textbooks and get out the new curriculum and go to the training and start using that new curriculum. None of that requires you to use the teacher evaluation process. But when you force that change, the precise nature of the problems you're seeing is going to shift. So it's important to update your claims as the situation changes. For example, let's say Mr. Roberts starts using the new curriculum, but he's continuing to basically just read from the teacher's guide without preparing anything in advance, so he doesn't really have the ability in the moment to address students' needs and make it engaging. If the new curriculum is much more rigorous and designed with students' needs in mind, we may no longer have an issue with Danielson Domain 1 Component C setting instructional outcomes. Or at least, I know if I bring that up, he's just going to wave the teacher's guide in my face and say he does have good instructional outcomes because they're written into the curriculum. So if the problem has shifted a bit, I'll need to revise my claim. So my next take on the claim might be something like this. Mr. Roberts consistently fails to adequately prepare for lessons, so he's unable to teach the curriculum effectively. Again, this is just my rough draft, which I'll have to compare to our evaluation criteria so I can see where it fits. And again, I may not find anything on planning because on paper, his lesson plans look great because they're copied straight from the curriculum. So I might look through the different criteria on planning and instruction and settle on 3C, engaging students in learning. When I see language like groupings of students are unsuitable to the activities, and the lesson has no clearly defined structure, and the pace of the lesson is too slow or rushed, that might ring a bell. And because I've looked at my teacher evaluation criteria, I now know the key issues that I can look for: student groupings, lesson structure, and lesson pacing. If Mr. Roberts is just reading out of the teacher's guide with no preparation in advance, I can make my claim more specific to the criteria, and I can make sure my evidence supports that claim. For example, my next shot at the claim might be something like this. Mr. Roberts has begun using our adopted curriculum, but without adequate planning and preparation. His lessons lack the necessary structure, appropriate pacing, and student groupings appropriate for the learning activities. So now I have a claim that I can back with evidence. So I might say, for example, on March 12th, Mr. Roberts had students sit at their desks for the entire period while he read from the teacher's guide. He asked 9 questions during a 43-minute period, and 13 of the 15 students he called on were male. He stopped on 17 occasions to read to himself from the teacher's guide while students waited. 23 minutes into the lesson, he said, "Okay, this part involves a lot of stuff I don't want to get out, so we're going to skip that," referring to an activity using materials provided by the curriculum. Students did not complete any work during these 43 minutes, and the instructional objectives of the lesson were not achieved. And then I could give other examples. Next, I want to go back to my claim and make sure it's general enough. So rather than say he hadn't been planning enough lately, I'll use that format that I shared in the last section. Mr. Roberts' practice in the area of engaging students in learning is characterized by heavy reliance on teacher-directed instruction, which, coupled with a lack of preparation, results in extremely low levels of student engagement. Then I'll include my evidence, then an interpretation, which will make it clear that this poor practice has an ongoing negative impact on students. For example, I might say, as a result of Mr. Roberts' lack of planning, students spend a great deal of class time sitting passively, not engaged in any meaningful learning activities, including those specified by the district curriculum. Then I can go right into my judgment. Therefore, in Domain 3, Component C, Engaging Students in Learning, Mr. Roberts' performance is most appropriately rated as Level 1, Unsatisfactory. So that's it. CEIJ. Claim, Evidence, Interpretation, Judgment. Give it a try now for one of your teachers who is currently struggling. Start with whatever degree of frustration you're feeling and whatever amount of information you currently have. Will you need to revise it so that it better aligns with your evaluation criteria? Yes, probably so. Will you need to collect more evidence? Yes, probably so. But it'll give you a great starting point to work from so that you can end up with a rock-solid, defensible argument. Now I'd like to invite you to use the form below to send me a draft CEIJ argument. Just leave out the teacher's name for confidentiality and call them Mr. X or Mrs. Blank or whatever, but then give me your best first draft of a claim, evidence, interpretation, and judgment argument. And if all you have is the claim and the interpretation right now, that's fine. Start with what you have, then build the rest of your argument as you continue to visit classrooms. That's it for now. Use the form below to draft your CEIJ argument, and I'll see you in the next section. Now that you know how to use the powerful claim, evidence, interpretation, judgment format for high-stakes negative evaluations, let's talk specifically about using them for positive situations. There are two distinct situations in which you might want to do this. The first is when you're rating a teacher at the highest levels in your evaluation rubric. If you have the evidence to justify an outstanding or exemplary or distinguished rating, whatever the top level is, it's important to substantiate that, just as you'd substantiate an unsatisfactory evaluation. Remember, our rule of thumb is that we default to satisfactory unless we have evidence that pushes us into another column in the rubric. So if you're going to turn in an evaluation that says distinguished, you want to use CEIJ to write that evaluation, so it's a clear-cut argument. For positive formal evaluations, the process is the same as we've already discussed. Make a claim about the teacher's typical practice in a given area, justify it with evidence, interpret its impact on student learning or other outcomes, and end with the judgment or rating. You won't have as much time to spend on these evaluations as you need to on negative evaluations, but I'd encourage you to still use the CEIJ format to make sure that top rating is really justified. Often we think of certain people as being really great, but when we look at the rubric, we don't really have the evidence to justify that top rating. So CEIJ can help you calibrate accurately. The second kind of positive situation where CEIJ can be helpful is in writing recommendations, which of course are very different from annual evaluations. But there's still arguments about teachers based on evidence, so we can follow the same general format. For example, let's say you're nominating a teacher for an award or a specialized role such as mentor teacher or instructional coach. Apart from how great that teacher is, the outcome of that application or nomination depends a great deal on the case you make in writing, and CEIJ can be a great help in making that case very strong. But it doesn't really make sense to use the CEIJ format in exactly the same way you would for a formal evaluation, so let's go through it point by point. First, the claim you make in a nomination or recommendation letter is probably going to be a more general claim, and it's probably not going to refer to your teacher evaluation criteria. If you're writing for an audience outside of your school district, it's probably not going to refer to your instructional framework at all, but instead to big picture values of the profession or of the organization that you're writing to. For example, let's say you're nominating a teacher for the ASCD Emerging Leaders Award. Rather than make a claim about the teacher's performance relative to your evaluation criteria, you'd make a claim that would appeal to ASCD's values, such as meeting the needs of the whole child and engaging in advocacy for students. Second, your evidence will consist of major accomplishments rather than specific classroom observations. For example, if a teacher led your school's social-emotional learning committee and brought about a bunch of positive changes in the school's culture, you'd talk about those accomplishments because they support your claim. Third, your interpretation will connect the teacher's accomplishments to real-world impact on students' well-being or their learning or the culture of the school or professional learning, whatever outcomes are most relevant. Finally, the judgment isn't going to be a rating at all. Instead, it's going to be your bottom-line recommendation about the teacher. For example, you might say, based on her track record of outstanding teaching, leadership, and passionate advocacy on behalf of students, I recommend Mrs. Ramirez without reservation for the ASCD Emerging Leader Award. Or, I recommend her without reservation for an instructional coaching role in our district. So to recap, you can still use the CEIJ format for positive evaluations, and if you do, you'll find that it keeps you honest and forces you to back your ratings with evidence. And if you're using CEIJ to write a recommendation letter, it'll still work, but with more of an appeal to the profession or the organization's values, rather than your teacher evaluation criteria, and with more of a focus on accomplishments rather than evidence from observations. So now I'd like to ask you, when do you anticipate using CEIJ for a positive situation in the next 12 months? Brainstorm a list, perhaps thinking back to letters and applications and forms you've been asked to provide for great teachers. Use the form below to let me know how you plan to use CEIJ for positives, and I'll see you in the next section. Let's recap some of the key approaches to high-performance formal evaluations that we've covered in this program. Here in Module 7, we've talked about doing formal evaluations more efficiently by dividing your staff into pre-check and enhanced screening groups using the 80-20 rule. Everyone goes through the same process, but rather than spend roughly equal time on each teacher, you're going to spend dramatically less time on most teachers, the 80%, and dramatically more time on those lowest 20% of teachers who are the highest risk for negative evaluations. We use this approach because it addresses the uncertainty of final evaluations. You don't know for sure who's going to turn out to be fine and who's going to be unsatisfactory at the end of the year. So collecting plenty of evidence in a deliberate and thorough way is really essential for those high-risk 20%. And as you gain more information, you can take people off of that list or move them onto it at any time. You have total flexibility for two reasons. First, it's all in your head. Teachers don't know which group they're in, so you can change your mind and reprioritize at any time. Second, no matter which group they're in, you're going to have plenty of evidence from your formal and informal visits to classrooms, so when it's time to write those final evaluations, you'll have all the evidence you need at your fingertips. For the 80% or more of your teachers who are satisfactory or better, the Anna Karenina principle tells us that just as happy families are all alike, according to Tolstoy, great teachers have a lot in common. So we can write our claims, interpretations, and judgments for one teacher, and then copy and paste that to all the other teachers it applies to, and just add the evidence specific to each teacher. This can save you a huge amount of time, because instead of writing 20 or 30 unique things for each domain of your evaluation criteria, you can write just 3 or 4 or 5 statements that will cover almost everyone except your struggling teachers. We also delved into the CEIJ format for writing strong evaluations in this module, and I shared examples of how you can use claim, evidence, interpretation, judgment for negative as well as positive evaluations. Most of the time, it's overkill, but when you need to make a strong case about a teacher's performance, CEIJ is priceless. No matter what the outcome, it's important that we stay focused on the purpose of evaluation. It's not to help teachers grow, even though we have related processes like reflection and goal setting and having conversations with teachers that may help them grow. Evaluation involves a real threat to teachers' livelihood, so it's only natural that it would trigger their natural defense mechanisms. So regardless of all the other work you do to help teachers grow, don't expect the evaluation process itself to help teachers improve. The process is designed to do one thing and one thing only, to initiate appropriate next steps for each teacher, whether the next step is to keep on doing what they're doing or to find another job. A lot of your ability to succeed in initiating those appropriate next steps through the final evaluation is going to depend on the foundation you've laid throughout the year, especially in terms of collecting evidence. Evidence of teacher performance relative to your teacher evaluation criteria is the number one thing you need to make a solid case. So the practice of visiting classrooms every day and taking low inference notes using the language of your instructional framework is essential. I want to challenge you to continue to visit classrooms 3 times a day, every day. So you're getting around to each teacher every few weeks. And so you'll have reams and reams of data to work with at the end of the year. Contrary to popular belief, I shared with you that I don't believe we should treat these informal visits as non-evaluative, because the individual lesson isn't what we're evaluating. It's not a gotcha where we're trying to catch teachers at their worst. We're evaluating the teacher's overall practice, and the more evidence and context we have about each teacher, the fairer and more accurate and defensible our final evaluations can be. In this process, you're relying heavily on your teacher evaluation criteria, but I want to refer you to Module 5, where we talked about how your evaluation rubric is just one part of your instructional framework. Here in Module 7, we haven't been talking very much about those other components, such as curriculum and school-specific expectations, because they're not officially the basis of your teacher evaluations, but they're incredibly important in giving you vocabulary to talk about and document what you're seeing in the classroom. For the vast majority of your teachers who are satisfactory, don't be afraid to spend more time talking about those more curriculum and pedagogy-specific elements of your instructional framework, because that's typically going to be a lot more valuable to teachers, and it's going to sharpen your focus when you're in the classroom. So let me leave you with a couple of action items. First, download the spreadsheet I've provided on this page for organizing your teacher evaluation evidence. Figure out which teachers can get the same general comments from you and figure out which teachers need to be on your enhanced screening list so you can be more deliberate about how you're documenting their practice. Second, keep up with your daily visits to classrooms, no matter what the timeline for formal evaluations is. Again, I highly recommend that you use our app Repertoire for taking your observation notes because it allows you to easily access the language of your instructional framework and quickly take time-stamped, low-inference notes and email them to the teacher. Please get in touch with us at any time if you need help with Repertoire. Third, when it's time to write your final evaluations, look over your records for each teacher and see what gaps you'll need to fill to ensure that each teacher receives an accurate evaluation that's supported by plenty of evidence. That's it for Module 7. Congratulations on making it this far. You're almost to the end. In Module 8, we'll bring it all together and connect the work you're doing in individual classrooms to school and district-level organizational learning. After you complete Module 8, you'll unlock the certification action steps. So if you've signed up for the optional certification, or if you want to add it by contacting our customer service team, you can begin working on your portfolio so you can earn the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification. When you do, you'll know, and you'll be able to prove to other people, such as potential employers, that you've mastered the mindsets, skills, and habits of a high-performance instructional leader. We'll have a plaque, just like this, engraved with your name and the date so you can display it with pride in your office. I'm Justin Bader. Thanks for being part of this program, and I'll see you in Module 8.